Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mat-Su Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find us over on social media. Just search for Dog Works Radio. And we can also be found over on iTunes. Just search for the same name. And do us a favor and post a review. It helps our rankings and lets people find our show over there. Calling in from Southern California is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's nice and cloudy and threatening to rain here, which, you know, the song says it never rains in Southern California, but sometimes it does.
You know, it's about the same weather up here in Alaska today, a little bit breezy, a little bit cool, but definitely all the leaves are popping out, and it is full spring up here in the mushing capital of the world of Willow, Alaska. You know, Alex, for the last couple of months, almost 3 months now, we've talked purely about Iditarod, Iditarod mushers, you know, the stories of Iditarod, but we haven't talked a lot about the dogs of Iditarod. And today we're going to talk about one story in particular. His name is Zeke. We actually talked to the person that broke the story just yesterday on our show. When we talked to journalist Craig Medred, we're going to talk about his story, Zeke, the miracle dog. And then if we have time, we're going to talk about some other famous dogs of the Iditarod and mushing. I'm sure Alex has quite a few stories to share since he is all about the Iditarod and making sure he finds all of these cool nuggets hidden in the backstories of all of these marvelous teams and marvelous mushers. So let's jump right in, Alex. What do you want to talk about the little dog named Zeke?
So Zeke, for those of you who haven't read the story, is a dog who was part of there was an Iditarod musher who had run an early race, was attempting to come back, build up his kennel, and unfortunately was not really able to follow through with this, was not able to take care of his dogs well enough, and many of his dogs were found malnourished, not really well taken care of, which, you know, is a horrible thing under any circumstance. So his dogs were brought to various animal shelters, and they were in very, very bad shape. They were, you know, they were mostly very malnourished. A lot of them were considered maybe touch and go for whether they would survive. But this particular dog was brought up to the an animal shelter in Fairbanks, and there was a pilot program that was funding some veterinary care for some of these recovered dogs who were in very bad need of care. And so this dog found its way there to Fairbanks, and then I'll let you take over the story a little bit from there.
Yeah, so Zeke, as Alex mentioned, he ended up in this shelter, and they have a program up there called the Fairbanks Animal Shelter Fund, and that nonprofit part of the shelter helps pay for veterinary care for badly ill dogs and trying to give them a chance for survival. This little dog, Zeke, was suffering from mange. If you're not familiar with what mange is, it's the dog that you typically think of that is, you know, a stray on the streets. He's missing patches of hair. Mange is from two things. They have either seborrheic mange or demodectic mange, and both of them cause very similar features. Typically, it is a mite-type insect or bug that whatever a mite is burrows under their skin and causes severe inflammation and infection, and hence they lose most of their fur. So little Zeke was suffering from mange, so the vets took care of him, and then a young lady by the name of Kaylin Davis, who is a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, took a chance on little Zeke and adopted him. And she is a young lady that has the big dreams, like so many folks do up here in Alaska, of one day running Iditarod. So she thought that she could hook up little Zeke with her other dog, and they ran, you know, on bikes and the two-dog teams and very small-type things. And she suddenly found out that this little dog had the power and the energy and the heart that he just wanted to go like nobody's business. And pretty soon she knew that if this little dog could be nurtured back to health, he could have some potential to be a very good mushing dog. Is that right, Alex?
Right. And, you know, we've talked a lot about what makes a great mushing dog. And it's so much a combination of a bunch of different things. Certainly the lineage is very important, and we always have people talk about Susan Butcher dogs and talk about getting, you know, Rick Swenson or Lance Mackey dogs. And that's very important that you have dogs that are bred from other dogs that have done well in races and that are natural leaders or that have a lot of strength and that can pull. So that's a very important part of it. But also there's kind of a hard to define just joy that certain dogs have when they are pulling a sled. And we've seen over and over again, there are dogs that seem like they are fairly typical, but then when they get in harness, something just snaps and they just become these amazing mushing machines. They just become these dogs that just want to go and go and go and snack a little and then go some more. So sometimes it's hard to know from the start where a dog is going to be until you actually take the dog out on some small runs, or you take the dog out ski-joring or you know, on some other kind of sport. And frankly, some dogs are not well suited to it, and you find that out, I think, fairly quickly. But it's a combination of the lineage and sort of this indescribable heart that great sled dogs all seem to have.
Right. So fast forward a couple of months there. Kaylin, I believe, Kaylin wanted to run in the Copper Basin, and she was working under the mentor of Alan Eichens. And we've talked about him a couple of times on our show over the last couple of years. He runs Double E Kennels in Wasilla, and she asked if she could run Zeke and Panda in the Double E team that she was planning on taking to the Copper Basin. And, you know, as long as everything worked out medically, Alan and Kaylin thought, wow, this is the dog that could potentially make the team. So they end up running in the Copper Basin, and they did very well. They quote in the article, we had a blast. We had a great race. So they were on their way, and then shortly thereafter, Alan asked this young lady if she could use Zeke in the Iditarod, thinking, well, you know, he might do okay for a couple 300 miles, which is very typical in mushing. Many times mushers will pick several dogs that they know, absolutely know going in, that they're not going to finish the race. They may run the first third of the race. They may run, you know, to the 24-hour checkpoint. They may run to the coast. They may be there for specific jobs, whether they're leaders or very strong team dogs when they're pulling over the Alaska Range. So mushers have a very distinct strategy in putting dogs in harness that they may or may not have any inclination whether they're going to finish or not. Is that right, Alex?
Right. And, you know, we've talked a bunch of times about what the goals are that mushers have when they take these younger dogs on not only Iditarod or Yukon Quest, but shorter races, you know, your qualifying races or your Copper Basin type races. And one of the primary things that people always talk about when they are running younger teams or running so-called puppy teams is that they want to make sure that racing and being out on the trails is a great experience for the dogs. So not only are they training the dogs in terms of being able to do longer runs and being able to camp or get used to sleeping at checkpoints and that sort of thing, but they are also getting the dogs used to the idea of being in race conditions. And the primary goal, I believe, or one of the primary goals that everyone always has is making sure that the dogs have a good time, that this environment is one that is a happy environment for them, that these are dogs that will get used to the idea of racing so that later when they are either on a more competitive team or running a longer race, they'll be able to really shine and really do well. And a lot of times that also means mixing some of these younger dogs with older or more experienced dogs so that the younger dogs will have dogs on the team that they can learn from. The other thing I wanted to mention real quickly is there's a picture in this article, and people who haven't seen the article should check it out on craigmedrid.news. There's a picture of the dog, and Zeke had, because of the issues with his fur, had a lot of kind of bare spots. And when Kaylin, she said that she wasn't sure for a few months what color he was going to be, because it wasn't really clear what his fur would be like when it grew in, or even if it was going to grow in. So when she first started taking him out on runs, she would have to have him in a sweater to make sure that, because he didn't have the fur to keep him warm, to make sure that he was able to keep warm when he was out on the trail when it was very cold. So all of those things go into, you know, what you're doing when you're training not only a dog like this, but any young dog that you think might be able to at some point be a first-class sled dog.
So, in fact, little Zeke and Alan Ishins made it to Nome, and in the article, Alan says, quote, he was a superstar the whole way to Nome. He was just the cheerleader. He was always first up, no matter how far we had run. He'd start howling and start barking and get the rest of the team up and ready to go, end quote. So, you know, this truly is the kind of feel-good story of the Iditarod dog. And as Kaylin says, when we first got the dog, we were sort of like, what are we doing? It's just a miracle that this little dog even lived and then turned out to be one of the best ones. This for a dog that wasn't supposed to be alive. You know, Alex, we've talked a lot about, you know, the difficulties in running Iditarod from a financial perspective, you know, how difficult it is to the money and to, you know, take care of all these dogs. And we've talked about, you know, the mushers that that drop out because they just can't afford it. And this is how little Zeke got his second chance. He came from a home that was, or from a kennel that was in dire straits. They could not afford to take care of all the dogs all of a sudden. And now this little guy not only is healthy, but also an Iditarod veteran. I think that says something about, you know, the determination of these little dogs and what they're able to overcome, you know, not only the adversity in living in such terrible conditions that he was, you know, growing up in, but also able to overcome, you know, the significant physical limitations and run the Iditarod and do very well. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of times if you go into a shelter, you know, your normal shelter, and you see a bunch of dogs that are up for adoption, you can't always tell what the, you know, what kind of dog this is going to be. And a lot of dogs, especially in shelter conditions, are maybe not coming from the best or most supportive background, but they are there. And certainly, you know, just forgetting about dog racing for a minute, if you're looking for a companion, a pet, that if you go into these shelters, I believe the dogs never forget that you have rescued them from the shelter. And, I grew up, around cities and in suburbs. So before I started getting involved with and interested in the Iditarod, I wasn't really aware of the fact that there were people who didn't spay and neuter all of their pets. And I eventually came to realize that if you're going to be, you know, starting a kennel and trying to raise raise and breed your own dogs, that's an important thing to do. But I had to get over that initial kind of prejudice about, well, why wouldn't you spay and neuter your dogs? The point being, and it's a long way around to get to this, there are amazing animals available in shelters all over the country, including in Alaska. Also in Alaska, there is often an opportunity. A lot of people who have great working kennels will have older dogs that they maybe don't have the resources to take care of, so they will sometimes adopt out to the right situation, retired sled dog. And I know a lot of people who have house dogs who used to be sled dogs, and they say that they still like to go out and run around and exercise, but they've really been able to adopt to, you know, living inside and being able to go up on the couch. So to take a very long time to get to this point, you can't ever really tell, but there's always a lot of potential in dogs at shelters.
You know, I totally agree, Alex. As a dog trainer for my job that pays the bills, I often see probably more than half of our dogs that we train are dogs that are rescued from shelters or from other rescue-type situations. And typically the new owner has no idea about the dog's past, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. They have no idea what they're getting into. And then they come to us and they ask us to work with them and their dog in training. And typically, some of these dogs do very well. They thrive in training. They thrive in the new home. And as you mentioned, they're often very accepting of their new home. But then on other times, they went to the shelter for a reason. They could have been aggressive. They could have bitten somebody. They could have, tore up the furniture, whatever reason. And I'm often pretty prejudicial to the previous owners by saying, typically it's not the dog's fault, it's the owner's fault, the reason why they're in the shelter. So I guess in a PSA-type statement here is always make sure that if you're going to invest the time, effort, and money in your dog, that you do it for the long term. In my opinion, dogs should not be disposable. They should be there for the life of the dog. And I think in a feel-good story like Zeke here, on the article at craigmedrid.news, it shows at the very top of the article what Zeke looked like at the beginning of his time with Kalen. And then at the bottom of the article, it shows him in the Iditarod or the Copper Basin, one of the races this past year. And he is a very strong, muscular, healthy-looking dog with a full coat, black with some white and tan on his face there, and he looks truly like a sled dog, doesn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely does. And I know that there are some of our listeners who may not have actually seen sled dogs in action, or maybe just seen clips on YouTube or clips on Iditarod.com, but there is nothing that I have experienced that compares to the power and joy of a team of sled dogs when they start. We've heard a lot about dogs who are just raring to go. And I've heard from a lot of mushers who talk about how their dogs finish Iditarod and a day or a day and a half later they're sort of in the dog lot at Nome saying, "We're ready, let's go for another 1,000 miles. So there is such an amazing amount of joy that these athletes get out of running, and it's such a wonderful story that Zeke was able to realize that and to become, you know, a superstar dog in training.
Right. You know, Alex, folks that have listened to this show for a long time, they know that that you're living down there in sunny Southern California, and you've spent a lot of time around sled dogs up here in Alaska as a fan. Of course, you're the fan of our show. You know, I'm the musher perspective, and you're the fan perspective. But I remember when you came up to our place a couple of summers ago, it was, you know, obviously all the snow had melted. The dogs were sort of lounging around their house, and they were just doing their thing in the off season. Can you give a fan's perspective of what you saw, whether at my kennel or other kennels, just kind of tell us about what you saw with some of these dogs, how they acted, how they interacted with you, how, you know, what were their attitudes? What were their personalities? Do you recall some of that, at least when you're up here?
Yeah. You know, just in general, when you walk around a dog lot, the dogs tend to get very excited. And usually that's because there's a limited amount of things that happen when someone comes into a dog lot. Usually it either means that the dogs are all getting fed, which is a happy thing that they like, or that the dogs are getting ready to go out for a run, which is something that they love. So my memory of walking around any dog lot, including yours, is that you come in, there are always a couple dogs who are sort of the ringleaders, who are the more vocal ones, and those dogs will start barking, will start letting you know that they're there in case there's a run that might happen, that they're ready for it. There's dogs that will sort of run around and jump up on top of their little dog houses. You also, in addition, get a clear sense of the personalities of some of the dogs. And there are some dogs that are just really, really playful, that when you come up to them, they like to sort of get down on their front paws and look at you, and then may faint to the right and go to the left. There are some dogs that just love to be petted and played with. And there are other dogs that are just, you know, they are there and they're happy to see people, but they're not quite as outgoing. Maybe they're not as outgoing with people they don't know, or maybe they're just not as outgoing in general. But the one thing that always strikes me about dogs in a dog lot is that the musher always knows everything about the dogs. So you go through a dog lot with someone who has who owns these dogs and has owned them for a while, or has worked with them for a while, or has worked with them from birth, and the musher will be able to tell you details about the dog's personality. They'll be able to tell you about silly things they did on a run. They'll be able to tell you about, this dog likes to chew out of harnesses. This dog, you know, always seems like he's about to run away, but then you call to him and he stays still. For every group of dogs, you know, if you have a dog lot that is relatively small and has maybe 20 or 30 dogs, there can be 20 or 30 different personalities, just like with people. And one of the things that always amazes me from a fan perspective is how a musher is able to figure out, and I know a lot of it is trial and error, and a lot of it is instinctive, but how you're able to figure out what combination of dogs will work best. And sometimes it seems like a certain dog because he or she is more, you know, more playful or doesn't really listen as well might not be a good dog to have on a team. But you find sometimes that if you have one of those dogs, that sometimes that dog will be able to fall into line when they're with a whole bunch of other dogs and be able to provide enough extra energy when the team as a whole is maybe a little bit down. So I personally love being in dog yards because if nothing else, you get to meet all of the dogs and you get to hear hear the stories of the dogs, and it just it underscores in a very big way how important these dogs are in the sport and how much the people who do the sport really know about and care about their dogs.
So, you know, Alex, our dog lot is currently 38 dogs spread over just under an acre. And a question for you, Alex, is I'm sure that most of our listeners, I would say more than 90% of our listeners, have never been in the middle of 30-plus dogs at any given time. And when they walk in, you know, they may go to the pet store, they may go to a shelter, and they see lines of dogs in kennels, but they're never fully immersed in that many dogs at one time. What was your initial impression of walking into your first dog lot where all of a sudden you have more dogs around you than you've ever had in your life?
It was such a happy feeling. I had been around the start of Iditarod and been around, you know, literally thousands of dogs. But to be in a dog lot with dogs who are all, you know, belonging to the same musher, on the same team, and hearing how at first a couple of them will start barking and more of them will start barking, and then it's like this crescendo, this almost musical, glorious sound of all of these dogs barking. And, you know, I can't pretend that I know exactly what all the dogs are thinking, but I know a lot of them are thinking something good is about to happen. And that's such an amazing and joyful feeling to be around.
So, you know, and the reason I ask you these questions, because we were talking about Zeke here and how he was that wonder dog on Alan and Kalen's team last year. But, you know, every musher has those stories. As you mentioned, all of us have those particular stories about that particular dog that did that remarkable task, whatever it is, whether it led through, you know, a raging snowstorm or crossed that open water or it bred that magnificent, you know, litter of puppies, or it lived to 16 years old and still wanted to run when he was 13. All of us mushers have those stories that we can share, but often, and I say this a lot on this show, often we only talk about the musher. And I know it's difficult to talk about 1,000 dogs during Iditarod because we just don't know the personalities of an hour upon hour trying to figure out these individual stories. But there truly are those remarkable stories, and we often hear about them. Alex, every year there will be a story during Iditarod. I'm sure you remember the little dog on Scott Jansen's team who literally died there on the trail, and he gave him CPR, and he popped back to life and went on to continue to be a sled dog for years to come. All of these stories are what makes Iditarod great, at least to me.
Yeah, I agree. And I just wanted to mention I know we're running a little close on time, but there have been a few very notable teams that were all or primarily rescue dogs. Colleen Robertia, who ran Iditarod in 2010 and 2012, her big thing, her big cause that she was trying to promote was dog rescue, and she had these coats that said, I believe, save one until there are none left to save, or something along those lines. And she did very, very well. It's a very inspiring musher. Finished 36th in 2010, and I believe 21st in 2012. Hasn't run since, but every year I keep hoping that she will come back and run, because it was so inspiring to see this team of rescue dogs. John Chandelmeyer entered the Yukon Quest in 2007, and he had a team that was entirely rescue dogs. When Lance Mackey got cancer, he gave away most of his kennel while he was being treated. And then when he was rebuilding his kennel, he rebuilt it primarily with dogs that had been, dogs that weren't good enough to race with other local mushers and with a couple of rescue dogs. And he just worked with those dogs and bred those dogs and was able to come up with a few phenomenal leaders. And for 5 or 6 years, just an unbeatable team of sled dogs that were dogs that had been, you know, deemed unworthy by everyone else.
Right. You know, there are plenty of stories just like that from all over the mushing community of dogs that have been rescued, or they were those outcasts or whatever from the other kennels, and they end up becoming remarkable athletes. Some of our best dogs are dogs that didn't make it on Hugh Neff's A-team, and they've gone on to run in my daughter Nicole's 2 junior Iditarods and many, many more races with us, many thousands of miles after their quote-unquote racing career was over. They've continued to provide us with many, many miles of joy and opportunities for mushing. So, Alex, anything else you want to mention in closing? I am so happy that we're able to talk about some dogs this time instead of, you know, all of the news that's been happening over Iditarod over the last few months, and, you know, some of that bad press that was out there over the Iditarod before and after. And now here we are in the off season, and I hope to have many more stories to come, at least until the Iditarod rolls around here in March. So I guess we'll go back to our typical 2-week schedule and try to find stories that we can talk about that may not be in the news, but at least stories we want to share. How about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing I just wanted to mention briefly is if you are lucky enough to talk to an Iditarod musher, or really a musher who's entered any kind of race, and you talk to them afterwards about their experience in the race, almost always they will tell you stories about something that one of the dogs did.
Right.
I know that we've been focusing a lot on the people and the personalities, but I think that we both would like to get back a little bit more to talking about some of these dog stories, because, as you said, almost everyone has one or two great dog stories from every race they run.
Yep, looking forward to it. So we will be back on the air starting on May 18th, which is Wednesdays. We'll be on a Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Alaska time, and then it will air at 5 p.m. here on KVRF 89.5, and then available as a podcast shortly thereafter. You can find us over on iTunes, and we highly encourage you to get out there and review our show. Tell us what you think, good, bad, or indifferent. We're always willing to make changes if we need to. One of the common comments on iTunes is sometimes the audio quality isn't good. I know, Alex, you and I have joked many a times of calling into the show in grocery store parking lots. I've been out on the road, whether we're traveling with the dogs or on vacation or whatever, so we don't have the ability to sit down in a studio like we should. But I think that's what makes this show special as well, is at least on my side, I'm out there living and breathing in it and every day. And, you know, you're a busy guy there in California, but you take time out of your day, whether you are, calling from a parking lot or calling from your home. We at least try to do our best and provide those stories that folks want to hear. Is that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have, I think we've certainly made a few mistakes over the years, and when people point out the mistakes to us, we are more than happy to correct them. We're certainly not perfect. Well, I'm certainly not perfect. You might be. But
nope.
But we definitely we really listen and take to heart everything that people say, and we are generally very easy to get to on social media, on Twitter or on Facebook, and always like to hear whatever is on people's minds, good, bad, or indifferent, like you said.
Very good. So if you guys have stories you want to hear, if you want us to research a topic, please let us know. You can reach out to us both on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Dog Works Radio. You can reach Alex over at Coldfoot Films on Twitter. He's very active there all year long, including those 24-hour shifts during Iditarod. So reach out to us. We'll make sure that we answer your questions here on the air. Alex, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host today, Alex Stein, we'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.